sleep like all at once. I wake up from something that keeps knocking at my brain. Before I go insane, I hold my pillow to my head and spring up in my bed, screaming out the words I dread. I think I love you.
If that song brings back memories, you were probably a young teenager in the early 1970s, and if you were a girl, you may well have been wearing Charlie perfume, platform shoes, and Mary Quant eyeshadow. David Cassidy was the teen idol of the time, star of the Partridge Family, and adored by millions of girls in America, the UK, and Australia. He was huge. British writer Alison Pearson was in love with David Cassidy, and in adult life, she actually got to meet him. She's the author of the bestseller I Don't Know How She Does It, about a woman struggling to do it all, but her new book explores the phenomenon of the teen idol, as well as the dynamics of friendship and the healing power of music, and Alison joins us on the line from the UK. Welcome to Life Matters. How serious were you about David Cassidy?
Well, I was obsessed with him. I tell you, I was so obsessed with him that I had read in a magazine that his favourite colour was brown. And I was living in South Wales, and for 18 months of my young life, I wore brown almost every day, including brown trousers and brown platform shoes and brown poncho. And I was very pale, sad, a little girl, and I looked terrible in brown. But I was so convinced that this was one of the key ways to becoming Mrs. David Cassidy.
Well,
so I
yes.
had to.
And what else did it involve, apart from walking around in a brown poncho? I'd forgotten about ponchos. But apart from brown, what else did it involve, being a fan, being a young teenager in South Wales at the time?
I think this whole romantic obsession, when I started thinking about writing the book, I thought it's so powerful because, you know, it's a kind of sort of dress rehearsal for love. I mean, not just wearing the poncho, but the whole range of feelings you go through. And I think a lot of it is, I think one of the ways that girls kind of take control of these situations is they kind of memorize all the facts about, you know, whether it's Donny Osmond or David Cassidy or David Essex, you know, all these guys. Bobby Sherman was big in America at the time. And I think that you just kind of know everything about them. So you know that, you know, I knew that when I finally got to meet David Cassidy on the beach in Hawaii where he had a house, that I'd have loads to talk to him about. And this is it's a kind of mad comic delusion. But I think I felt in the book what I was talking about was it also touches on some quite profound things.
Well, that's it. And you knew all this. You knew to wear a brown bikini on the beach because of these fan magazines, didn't you?
Yes, the fan magazines, absolutely. And in I Think I Love You, you've got the girl's voice, which is very impressionable, and saying, you know, oh my God, we're going to this concert. I've got, you know, 373 David Cassidy posters. But then you've got the character of Bill, and Bill is a young journalist who wants to be a hotshot rock journalist. But poor boy, he's ended up writing the David Cassidy, letters from David Cassidy to the girls for the David Cassidy Essential magazine. And he's the one who makes all the stuff about what favourite colour David has and so on.
Yeah. Now, what was it about him that was so compelling, so attractive at the time?
Well, I think it may be quite hard to explain to a member of the opposite sex, because my husband, who whenever I, of course, David Cassidy is mentioned a lot in this household, and my husband kind of exclaims, but he was basically a girl. And of course, he was looked like the prettiest looking girl you've ever seen, totally hairless. All the great teen idols have almost no hair on them at all. They're very androgynous.
Yes.
And I think that's part of the appeal, you know, because I think that the teen idol is this kind of transitional love object between, you know, liking guinea pigs and kittens and horses. And before you kind of graduate onto real, slightly scary, hairy men, there are these lovely, beautiful, kind of calf, Bambi-eyed teen idols in between. And David Cassidy was just the most gorgeous of those, really. And you know, we all knew he was the perfect guy, I guess.
Yeah, I'm just looking at pictures of him now. There's one very fetching one where he's on the beach in a pair of white swimming costumes. Yes.
I really appreciate the research you've gone to here.
Look, we take it seriously. Now you went to a concert in London which you describe vividly in the book. What's your memory of that experience?
Do you know, I didn't attend that concert. I did go to another concert in Manchester, but there was a famous concert at White City where a girl was very tragically sort of trampled and ended up dying. And I mean, my memory of going to the concert was just, you know, it's kind of overwhelming. You're in a kind of stadium with sort of 40,000 girls who all think they're going to become Mrs. David Cassidy, and they're all moving towards him like he's the prize. So it was, I remember it being both a kind of thrilling, wonderfully thrilling and exciting night of my life, really. You know, finally you're going to go and see this person you've been dreaming about. And but also, it's, you know, it's pretty amazing to be in somewhere where you've got kind of, you know, 35,000 pairs of platform shoes stampeding really, yeah, towards the stage.
Yeah. Now, I mean, you've already told me, you know, you think people like him at the time, and indeed teen idols generally do feel an emotional need. Now, what about your own daughter? Because she's been roughly of that age herself, hasn't she?
Yeah, she's been. It's very good as a novelist to have a character the same age as your heroine in the house. So Evie is now 14 and is obsessed with Robert Pattinson, the guy from the Twilight films. Mm. And she's also pretty keen on Justin Bieber, who I know caused a bit of a stampede over there recently, didn't he?
He did. He came and people, all these girls as young as 12, it transpired,
yeah,
which of course prompted everybody to think, what are their parents thinking? We're in the middle of Sydney in the middle of the night, hoping, yeah, to see him, and there was going to be a free concert or something, and it had to be cancelled, and they're all there at 3 o'clock in the morning. It was ridiculous.
Well, you know, I think that parents of every generation say, oh, this is absolutely ridiculous. But I think if you trace it back, you know, I mean, it goes all the way to Frank Sinatra and New York at the Paramount when Screaming Girls stayed in the theatre in sort of 1939 all night and didn't leave. So it's kind of 'twas ever thus. I mean, I think that each generation finds its own teen idols. And it's incredibly vivid, you know, in the memory. I was talking to your lovely producer earlier, and she's my vintage, and, you know, she has exactly those same memories. And I think it's very potent, you know. When I started thinking about the book, I thought, well, I remember more about David Cassidy than I do about kind of, you know, my actual boyfriend. So as I said, it's both, seems like both a silly crush, but, you know, also it kind of lives on through your life, really. I can remember all the words of all his songs. And when I went to interview him in Florida, I mean, I got him to sing one of his songs, and I remembered the words better than he did.
Oh. Actually, that is, I find that completely fascinating. That's in the afterword of the book, where you do, as a, you know, a senior journalist and important enough to be flown overseas to meet him, you get to do this. Hardly anyone gets to do this. Mm. And you get to have a heart-to-heart. That must have been, well, an odd experience.
Well, it was an odd experience, but the idea of I Think I Love You was kind of crystallizing in my mind, and I thought, wouldn't it be amazing to go and actually meet him? You know, I mean, all those years later, I mean, it's just, you know, the kind of vertigo of the years, you know, thinking back to that period. And as I was going to meet him, I did agonize over whether I should wear brown, but it was Florida, it was very hot. I thought, he's going to think I'm a complete maniac if I turn up in a pair of brown crimpline flares. So I chose something a bit more suitable. But I remember going to see him and being in the cab and thinking, oh God, don't, you know, please don't let me pity him, because I felt I could deal with any emotional reaction to him, but I didn't want to pity him because, you know, he bestrode my world, my 14-year-old world, like a kind of colossus in a white cat suit,
yes,
with sequins on. And I didn't want, you know, I think you want your heroes to you know, to be as kind of, you know, as fantastic as you thought they were, really.
Two things. Firstly, I think we should absolutely nail down the issue of brown. Was brown really his favourite colour?
No, in fact, I think people who pick up the book will read in the interview. I finally said to him, you know, can you just confirm that your favourite colour was brown? And he said, Alison, do I look like someone whose favourite colour is brown? So that was one of the lies we were sold, along with the many lies that teenage girls are sold. And that's another theme of the book, really. I mean, I bought on eBay lots and lots of the magazines of the period, the Jackie magazine and the Pink magazine, and what struck me is, you know, how at what a young age girls are taught to feel discontented about themselves. You know, it's like, identify your weak points, you know. Is your neck too short, you know? Is your neck too long? All this stuff about how you could disguise your weak points. And I'm looking at my daughter, you know, I was looking at my daughter now and thinking, she's 14, you know, she's got a 24-inch waist. You think, it's not going to get much better than this, honey. Make the most of it.
On Life Matters today, my guest is Alison Pearson, the British journalist and writer, and we're talking about I Think I Love You, which is her new novel. It's from Random House, and it explores all sorts of issues, the teen idol, female friendship, music, the whole thing. Now, we rejoin you, Alison, in your meeting with David Cassidy years later as a proper grown-up. I've always been told by friends who write about sport that it's a bad idea to meet your heroes.
Mm-hmm.
Were you disappointed or what?
No, you know, it's turned into a fascinating meeting. I think that he is at a place in his life where he's able to reflect really intelligently and sensitively on what he went through. And it was strange. It was like sort of two sporting teams that, you know, he was thousands of miles away in California with all that stuff happening to him, and I was in South Wales, and I was on the other end of the experience. So we kind of compared notes on it, and it turned into one of my favorite interviews I've ever done, actually. I really got a lot out of it. I just thought it was extraordinary. And at one point he said to me, I said, well, I come here today to meet you. And he said, you know, and you don't give a damn, right? I'm just some 50-something guy. And I said, you know, on the contrary, it's, you know, I do believe that we measure out our lives in these quite small ways. And I said, you know, in the years to come, one day I'll be listening to my kitchen radio and the announcer will say, you know, David Cassidy, the 70s teen idol, died today. And I said, I do think a part of me will die with you and a part of millions of women will die with him. I really do believe that. So these slightly unlikely people become, you know, they hold part of us through our lives. I really think that.
But what effect did that experience of being in that position, adored by millions of girls, have on his life, especially when it was finished?
Yeah, obviously, to be at the height of your powers at the age of 24 and everything, to be kind of downhill after that is a pretty disconcerting experience. And, I mean, he chose to get out, and he talked very movingly about how, you know, Michael Jackson was his direct contemporary, and he talked about the kind of lunacy that had overtaken Michael Jackson and so on. So I think he's done pretty well, but you know, teen idol, any kind of child stardom is pretty disconcerting, isn't it, really? I thought very much about that Petra, my heroine, this young girl, this is what she thinks. She believes with all her heart that she's in love, you know, and I think that the book really goes on to be a kind of examination of how does the female attitude to love change throughout our lives, really, you know. And I think that the David Cassidy love was not true. I mean, it was based on something that, you know, was patently made up. We were bombarded with publicity about him, and it wasn't true. And yet, it was a love story we made up and told to ourselves with all our hearts. And in a way, it is true, even though it's false. So there's a sort of strange thing about maybe love, you know, love is a fantasy, but it's true to the people who tell it to themselves.
It's incredibly powerful for telling it to yourself. Now, of course, there's more to this book than David Cassidy. Female friendship, friendships between girls is a big part of it, and Petra desperately wants to be included by her circle of friends, especially the alpha girl, Gillian. Mm-hmm. And it can be, and you explore this a bit, a pretty cruel dynamic.
You know, I think that was one of the things I felt going back to that era in my mind, was remembering all that kind of horrible insecurity and, you know, are you in the gang? You know, are you... I mean, there's a scene where the girls are all walking down the road and Gillian, who's the queen bee, has allowed her, the favourite girls of the day, to hold her arm, and then the second favourite girls are allowed to hold the arms of the girls who are holding Gillian's arm, and so on, until you get to Petra, who's my heroine, who's basically kind of walking along in the gutter on the kind of outside of the chain. And I talk to some of my good female friends now about this era, and they all said, my God, I would not go back to being 13 for £1 million. I think, you know, it's a really difficult time. You're kind of, you know, you're developing a self. You're wondering who yourself is. At the same time, you're trying to figure out your position in this, you know, sort of shifting hierarchy. And girls can be little horrors to each other, I have to say. Petra reflects on what it's doing to herself, and she say, you know, to keep him with the gang of girls, you made yourself, you know, less intelligent and less kind. You know, she feels there's a price to be paid for membership of the group with this girl running it according to her rules, really. But also, it's one of the great things about growing up is you can look back and you can think that some of the kind of Gillian queen bees, you know, they're not the women who necessarily go on to, you know, to make something of themselves in later life. So that's something for us to cling on to.
Yes. when you look back, and you've obviously had to do this just to write this, what's to be gained? Does it help you understand who you are now better?
I think it does, but also I think it's really helped me seeing with my daughter and, you know, and her friends. And, you know, I mean, these things that, you know, they just go on. And, you know, it would be my dearest wish, actually, that my daughter's age group, you know, would read the book and would give them the opportunity to discuss and reflect on what it is that girls do to each other and maybe why they do it. You know, I mean, I'm kind of revving up for the sort of competition of love, really. And I think, you know, there are lots of things that they don't need to do, which are to do with insecurity, basically. And I think that, you know, that girls use bitching to bond. I mean, that's the way they do it. They bond with each other by bitching about somebody else. And, you know, it's not a very helpful pattern, I don't think. And it would be great if I Think I Love You could be used by girls to reflect a little bit on why they do what they do.
Well, readers loved I Don't Know How She Does It, because I think all around the world, women reflected on their own lives, the juggle and the struggle, and I know you've struggled with doing it all yourself, the two kids and the journalism and everything. How are you going with that?
Well, I think because I wrote I Don't Know How She Does It, I think I made the mistake of thinking I kind of inoculated myself against the stress disease. But I've had a kind of bumpy time trying to write this second novel. Plus my mum was not well, and, you know, I've got two young children, and, you know, it's the story that lots of women have in their lives. And I ran into a spot of depression, which I've kind of been dealing with and coming through now. But the great thing, one of the great things about having written I Don't Know How She Does It was, you know, just having literally thousands of stories sent in by women. I mean, some of them very sad, some of them absolutely hilarious. And it's a great feeling, and it's one of the best things about being an author is to share, to feel that people will read your book and they'll say, oh my God, that woman's been living inside my head. You know, that's exactly how I feel. That's my life you're talking about. And it's a great privilege. It's the great privilege and joy of being a writer is that, you know, people feel you've tapped into something that maybe they haven't expressed to themselves in those words. But when you say it, they say, yeah. And a lot of women who are reading I Think I Love You Now are, you know, getting in touch with me, emailing me and saying, oh, you know, oh, I had those shoes, or, you know, I had the eyeshadow, I look terrible, you know, all this stuff. And it's just, it's wonderful sharing the memories.
Well, I'm sure that a lot of people listening to this now will get in touch with us at the very least. Alison, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Alison Pearson has been my guest, and she's the author of I Think I Love You, which is published by Random House. And, well, were you a fan of David Cassidy or the Bay City Rollers or Leif Garrett or Leif Garrett? I'm not sure how to say that, actually. Or Duran Duran or New Kids on the Block or Frank Sinatra. Any of those people, you will remember, if you were, how it made you feel. Get in touch. Let us know. abc.net.au/rn/lifematters. Is the website. You can always just send a comment, or you can send an email from there, or you can always give us a ring, 02 833 1430.